This is a very special lecture by Geraldine Duke, from Geraldine Duke, who was made a fellow of the Institute in 2016. As we know, the topic tonight is foreign affairs as a water cooler conversation, the challenge awaiting us. And I think that's a terrific cartoon that Ash found. I'd like to extend a particular welcome to everyone who's here tonight. There are a number of life members who are here. There are a number of donors to the Institute who are here. There are a number of committee members who are here, including a fellow from the Institute, Professor Samina Yasmin, and we'll introduce Samina later, but she runs the Centre for Muslim States and Societies. Members of the Institute, members of the Young Professionals Network, and new members, and a particular welcome to new members who are here tonight. And as a result of being new members, I should may as well announce it now, we've entered into a relationship, a corporate relationship with La Luna, and they've kindly donated some cinema tickets to events at La Luna. So the new members can come and see Ash and our secretary over there. And Ash will get the details and we'll make sure we get those tickets. So it's good to be together with La Luna. I'd like to acknowledge a few special guests tonight. I always acknowledge Dr. Sue Boyd, my predecessor, as president of the Institute. But I see former Senator Alan Eggleston there, who represented Western Australia in the Senate from 1992 to 2014. And amongst his many roles, he had a role in the Senate Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, and a particularly good paper was produced by that committee on the Indian Ocean. I'd also like to acknowledge Melissa Park, who's here tonight as former member for Fremantle in the House of Reps, and she too was on the Joint Standing Committee for Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade. Well, she was on the Joint Standing Committee, I should say. Senior international lawyer, postings including Kosovo, Gaza, Lebanon, Cyprus, and New York, and now in Perth. So nice to see you here, Melissa. And another Melissa Connolly Tyler, who's our, we're very pleased to have you here, Melissa, as well. She's our indefatigable National Executive Director for the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and she's been doing a great job since 2006, running our national office. And she too has a distinguished career in international relations and went to arguably Australia's best university, the University of Melbourne. But unlike some people, she was a senior fellow. But I also just saw Robin McClellan pop in, former US Consul General here and now Head of Leadership, Western Australia. So welcome. Welcome everyone. I'm going to get through everyone. The format tonight, in a minute I'll introduce our special guest, but I'll say a few words about our bursary program. I'll then introduce Geraldine. We'll have time for question and answers. Professor Samina Yasmin will give a vote of thanks, and then we can progress to what's described as heavier refreshments and networking of the program. Geraldine was raised in South Perth, I believe. And studied at the University of Western Australia, and from my readings, was interested in becoming a teacher, and then had something of an epiphany on St George's Terrace, is that correct? And wandered into the West Australian. And she is now, I think it's fair to say, one of Australia's most respected journalists, so it was a good epiphany. And the whole family seems to be connected with journalism. Including in-laws, most recently.
I refer to that.
But many of us know and are very fond of Geraldine, if we've never met her before, from such programs as Compass and Life Matters on the ABC. I had the pleasure of seeing Geraldine at the 2016 National Conference, where she was there with the Honourable Michael Kirby and our own Akram Azim, talking about Australia's contribution to global issues. She has received particular commendations, UN Awards and Penguin Awards, for her coverage of the Gulf Wars. She's an officer of the Order of Australia. She has four children. She's a Churchill Fellow and she's a fellow of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. So with that, I'd like to welcome Geraldine tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. I'll just make sure that that's on. Is that on? Yes? No?
No.
All right. It should be. I've
got Go, Ash.
How's that?
Hang on, Ash.
Just a moment. We'll just wait a little. I'm sorry. I hate doing this, but...
Or do we need to move it up, Ash?
Is that better? Is that better? No, it's not better. Okay, hang on a check. Maybe we move that up. To just put it down there. Sorry. It should be... Okay. There we are. Oh, I'm so sorry, everybody.
Something of an AAA tradition. This is all.
Take it away. How's that? Is that a bit better? Does that help?
Yes.
It's just that I've got various bits of paper to handle, so I can't really use one of those.
That sounds pretty good.
Is that okay? I hope that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay.
Don't worry, Jill.
You're worried, Sue.
I am.
Yes, you know, I can tell you're worried.
That's okay.
How's that? That's better. I think that's better. I'm sorry. It's dreadful when women fiddle with technology. Anyway. Well, ladies and gentlemen, look, thank you very much indeed for welcoming me to this. It really does mean a great deal to me. And I want to thank both the Centre for Islamic Studies, Samina's here, Samina Yasmin, and the AAIA, which has such a venerable history of trying to foster wider discussion or conversation among the Australian people of our place in the world, and to prompt a wider range of Australians, not just those of us who are fascinated by the topic, to engage in this neighbourhood of ours and see it as a neighbourhood. This is my sort of great, just watch the time, this is my great obsession, that we think of our region as our neighbourhood, with the way we think of neighbours. There are close neighbours, there are medium neighbours, there are far away neighbours. There are people we really wish to have dinner with and a drink with, and there are those that we'd care to keep at a distance. We certainly don't want to engage in hostilities with. And that's what I'm absolutely obsessed by, and am trying to introduce this notion that water cooler, which is almost the sort of symbolism for the discussion that you have when you just gather intuitively without a great deal of fuss and organisation, and you talk about things in a way that where you don't need a doctorate to be engaged in the conversation. That's my particular obsession, and I've been trying to introduce that in this later part of my journalism, and it just means a great deal to me, and I'll explain, it'll become, I think, apparent why it matters that there's a recognition of it by something like the Australian Institute of International Affairs, which has, as I said, played this role for so many years now. Now, I have a very personal involvement, as John said, because my son-in-law, Adam Harvey, was the man shot in the Philippines just on 2 weeks ago while covering the hostilities in Mindanao, which has provided a fantastic backdrop to tonight's event. It's made it very personal. It's very much a neighbourhood issue, as it were, and there's just simply nothing like it for forcing you to realise that this is something that you need to engage with in a way that you haven't before. I'm going to read you various things because one of the things I would suggest is that you do find your favourite reading beyond the standard fare, because I think it's the only way, myself, that you become interested in a topic like this. And my first, I subscribe to something called Geopolitical Futures, which George Friedman, who is an American commentator, set up. I think George is probably a spy, actually, because he seems to be amazingly linked into, he gets information sooner than anybody else, and I'm convinced that if he isn't in the CIA, he was in the CIA in some form, and you get fantastically, he's a Hungarian Jewish man, and you get fantastic analysis, but this was from one of his operatives, Philip Orchard. Cooperation among Southeast Asian states has never come easy, but the surge of Islamist militancy in the region is encouraging Malaysia, Indonesia and the Philippines to give it another go. Of course, the patrols alone, the trilateral patrols in the Sulu and Celebi seas, the patrols alone will not rid the Philippines or its neighbours of jihadists. The same issues that have routinely hindered collective action throughout Southeast Asia will limit the scope of the program, if not undermine its effectiveness altogether. But the initiative does amount to a step towards regional integration, even as it proves the indispensability of the US and its allies in Southeast Asia. Now, that sort of talk is the formal talk. And my argument is that it actually acts as a barrier to a lot of our confreres engaging in this vital conversation that I'd like more and more of us to be involved in. And in a way, when Adam was shot, and my daughter has two little children, 3.5 and 8 months, who are coming to stay with me tomorrow, you see the size of the M16 bullet that mercifully stopped a centimetre from his carotid artery, true, a centimetre. Mm. And we had to, in that day, when, you know, someone from Foreign Correspondent who'd commissioned him to do the story came up to me and pulled me back from the lift as I was off to lunch Thursday, 2 weeks ago almost, and said, "Geraldine, I need to talk to you." And I thought, well, why doesn't he come and join me in the lift? We'll travel. He said, "There's been an incident. Adam's all right, but it's stray shrapnel." This is a complete surprise, and because I'd been watching him do these amazing pieces of camera on the news with his full, you know, gear. And the only other people I'd seen from the ABC News doing those sorts of things were people who were accompanying the soldiers into the attempt to liberate Mosul. And it was a bit of a shock to see Adam like that. But then about an hour later, he rang me again, this same producer, Mark Corcoran, said, "I'm afraid it's a little more serious. It is a bullet, and we're trying to get him out." But a firefight had erupted around the hospital where he'd had that X-ray that he tweeted instantly, showing the bullet lodged a centimetre from his carotid artery. And they couldn't actually get them out for an hour and a half. And they actually thought that it was possible that IS would walk in the door. Mm. Now, that was very confronting. Because his Filipino fixer, called Boy, isn't that dreadful, but there you go, Boy had said to the crew, John, who was from Foreign Correspondent, Jeff Thompson and Phil Hemingway from Perth, actually, he said to them, "They'll take you captive, but they'll make an example of me within a second." Now, it didn't happen. That's the point. It didn't happen, but the army is not winning. And you can't trust the army's remarks. And that's become, you know, all of a sudden, of course, I've now sort of skilled myself up on Mindanao, as have a lot of the, there was a very good piece on my network, Radio National, on Rear Vision on Sunday at midday. And if you want to get the history of it, it's utterly fascinating. This has been a very, very interesting, complex story for 400 years. And IS has walked in, well, got in there with some money from people in Jakarta. And this is what I think becomes, it forces a reassessment, which is exactly what we're going to live through. Now, I actually, there's such different remarks. Matt Williams wrote in John Menadue's blog called Pearls and Irritations. John Menadue used to be head of Prime Minister and Cabinet under both Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser, which is, you know, a very interesting sort of result. Matt Williams, former ambassador to the Philippines, and he wrote warning Australia about thinking of getting involved. "The current situation in Mindanao has long and tangled roots, making it so different from elsewhere in the global war on terrorism. This presents a serious challenge for Australia, as much of our resources traffic to Northeast Asia from WA, transits the Cebu Channel and the Sulu Sea, and further north into the South China Sea. It provides a safe haven for jihadists geographically much closer to Australia. Abu Sayyaf have already boarded a Korean cargo vessel in the Cebu Channel, travelling from Australia earlier this year, which went unreported by the Australian media, all of which suggests that Australia should exercise extreme caution about any military involvement as a response to the media reporting of the current scene in Mindanao. So that was his very careful overview. A Filipino cardinal, Orlando Quevedo of Cotabato, he had a totally different perspective. He actually, as a good cardinal ought to, alerted us to the economic and the political roots of terrorism. He remarked and alerted us, in a way that none of the rest of the media has really done, to the fact that poverty in the province has worsened over the last decade, from just 44% in 2006. The data showed the poverty rate in the province, which has a population of 1 million, rose dramatically to 74% in 2015. Mindanao's problems, he says, are complex. Decades of government neglect, inequality and political exclusion have spurred numerous rebel groups into waging an insurgency for greater autonomy. To date, 11 out of the 20 poorest provinces in the country are in Mindanao. Now, I certainly didn't know that before Adam was shot. I don't advocate that, but you know, this is what I'm trying to say. If it's personalised, it's the effect on one is extraordinary. And I think this is what I'm thinking about for Australia. Then, the pièce de résistance, as it were, came from former CIA chief David Petraeus, General Petraeus, who's commanded Australian troops in two theatres in Iraq and Afghanistan, really laying it on us. This is not a problem that can be resolved in years, but in decades, and one where Australia could take the lead. It's a generational struggle, he goes on to say. He says that the outbreak was a failure of vigilance by governments, including his own countries. Collectively, a lot of us, including the Philippines government, which was concentrating its effort on counter-narcotics, she says, raising her eyebrows, took our eye off that particular ball. It shows you have to have a sustained commitment. As Daesh is forced, as yielding territories in Iraq and Syria, it has opened a front in the Philippines. By establishing a base for Daesh operations across the region, they posed a direct threat to Australia and our interests. That's our Defence Minister, Maurice Payne, suggested. And it was actually suggested, Mr. Petraeus said, that it could be a bit like Mali, which turned, if you recall, to its former colonial ruler of all things, France. They worked out they'd lost control, and they turned to France under a UN mandate. Paris mobilised and contained the uprising, but 5 years later, listen to this, 11,000 UN and French peacekeepers remain in Mali. And a state of emergency is in force till about October. So, this is really a challenge, I would put to you. How do we draw Australians into that conversation more? Because, let's face it, it's arcane. It's about a neighbourhood that is self-evidently remote. It taps lots of fears that are so deeply embedded we may not have even articulated what they are. And it seems insoluble. I often say to people who really criticise the media, I think the media plays, you know, doesn't know how to cover a lot of this, but they say, why doesn't the media cover events in Uzbekistan the way they cover Paris? And I say, well, you know, the media, it knows its recipients become weary and exhausted from societies that can't appear to solve their own problems. It devotes a certain amount of attention, and then it says to us, and we get this, it's an instinct you build up, they say, oh, look, I've got an exhaustion, I can't take any more in. And my argument is, if we just keep repeating a solid litany of tragedy and insoluble issues, we will have them turning on us. They'll say, we won't even try to listen to you. And then they do become really sort of prone, I think, to demagogues and to appalling stuff. So into the vacuum, beware of vacuums, I believe, in this area. The vacuums produce demons. Some of the difficult stuff produces weariness and sort of small terrors. I contend they're better than the demons induced by vacuums. Maybe we can take that up later. So what has become water cooler conversations? Well, the Four Corners discussion around China has become a water cooler conversation. And is it a good one? I don't think so. I think that, in fact, quite a lot of the conversation that has been swirling around of late has been lacking altogether in nuance, lacking altogether in the dilemmas we're faced with, completely lacking in the effort at sophistication and balancing off forces that Hugh White, Professor Hugh White from the ANU, who I think has really been leading this conversation, as it were, for years now, sort of saying, we have to become far more sophisticated in the way we deal with the fact that our very best friend, the United States, which we say, and that recent Lowy poll suggested we think is our sort of absolute insurance policy, a very big investor, but not our biggest trading partner, is not necessarily on the same page, in fact, often not on the same page, as our biggest trading partner. And I always feel that here in WA, there's a much stronger sense, as somebody put it to me once, we know in WA that China says signs our paychecks. It's a very, very blunt thing that was said to me a couple of years ago when I was here. This is when the mining boom was at its peak. So that is a tricky balancing act, that it requires adult thinking, not adolescent thinking, to say, well, how are we going to do this? Can we walk and chew gum? I think we can, by the way. I absolutely think we can. I think we're extremely pragmatic people, much more than a lot of the other, you know, you go to countries for conferences and you think, oh, gosh, they're amazingly sort of bifurcated, you know, in zones. I actually think we're a small country. We know we can't do it all by ourselves. It makes us very pragmatic. And I think that's what we need to promote. That's what I think that I need to promote as somebody who's got this privileged position in the media, which tries not to play into some deep-seated things that you just scratch, you know, those inscrutable Orientals, what are they doing to us, you know, from China. I find it very depressing when we come back to those taglines and spies from China undermining us. Now, there are some things that need to be called out, but the notion that we can just sally forth without any sense that there are downsides to this conversation, giving vent to all our fears, well, I think we're absolutely kidding ourselves. So I had a different idea. I wanted to set up something that I sort of thought, because in the media at the moment we're completely induced to think about the new digital world and to think about different forms of listening. And these days you've got to come up with little formats which preferably have a cute title. So I came up with something called A Foreign Affair, which I thought was a bit cute. And I wanted to shoot the breeze, as it were, with people a bit like the drum on News 24, where people are called in to sort of discuss. They might have a working knowledge of they're assumed to be up to date, relatively, but they're not specialists. But they're concerned enough to want to discuss around, as you would around a water cooler, with a little bit of energy, not just sitting back, laid back. And I wanted to do that on foreign affairs, which I thought was so that I wanted people to have the same degree of interest as they would in, say, police rounds, as they would in politics, national politics, which is far too covered as far as I'm concerned. But that's what I wanted to do. And I proposed this podcast, which I thought was an absolute given, where we'd have a stable of, you know, we'd have a stable of guests who had a working knowledge of this, people who were used to making it successful, have a bit of fun, a bit of a laugh, you know, but really cared about it. And I thought, you know, judging by the numbers of people taking up international relations courses from universities across Australia, I thought, like young people, the demographic that matters, that this was really a sitter. And I was dead wrong. It didn't work. the people allocating the money for tiny bits of money for, say, a production assistance and to sort of the support that you needed to do podcasts. No, I barely got a hearing. Mm. It was quite depressing. I thought, right, this is, and I know that what's happening at the moment is that I think there is a, to be honest, I think there's a dumbing down of national conversation. I think there's a shallowness, and there's a very much a small, localised sense and a perception that there's no appetite among a lot of people, but including the younger demographic, for these broader discussions, which I think is dead wrong. But after I got over the sort of wounded pride, I thought, okay, what are you going to do about this, Geraldine? You're going to put it into your own program and you're going to win the argument by demonstration. So once a month on my program, Saturday Extra on Radio National, the last Saturday of the month, I have this half an hour which we dedicate called A Foreign Affair, and I've had a very, very good response. I'm going to read you some of the very interesting letters I've had back from listeners, which has been immensely rewarding. Have they listened to up at the top? Doesn't matter if they, but I'll make sure they do. But my instinct is, this is what you've got to do, you know? You've got to, you don't give up, but you prove it. And you swallow your pride and you get on with it. And this is some of the feedback. Susanna writing, I so enjoyed the Foreign Affairs segment. I completed undergrad and postgrad science at uni, and I struggle with my naivety re politics, power and international affairs. I rely on clear thinking, clear talking, well-informed experts in the field to distill for me. The news hype rarely helps. That was exactly my instinct. In fact, I think it repels. Thoughtful Aussies probably do need to get into this serious stuff more than ever, and getting the occasional wake-up scare in attempting to be alert and best prepared for the 21st century may be a lot more useful for analytical planning for Australia than thinking we can continue to doze away at the safe end of the earth. Linda wrote, in a time when the dumbing down of the populace seems to be gathering momentum, your concept of a panel discussion about foreign affairs and how they may affect global relations, safety, prosperity, is so wise and so welcome. Thank you for reinserting into our homes the impetus to think deeply about what's going on in the world. David wrote this, very interesting. Having worked in the foreign affairs for over 30 years, albeit in a modest career, I can say that heads of government, bilateral visits, HOG, that's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade acronym, bilaterals are essential and often helpful. We had a program saying, do they really matter? And often helpful to our interests. But they can also cause problems, especially when personal friendships become warm and a sense of mutual accommodation and even obligation develops, which I thought was quite an interesting observation. When HOG get together, they talk to people who share a similar burden of responsibility, sometimes isolation, with party problems and domestic frustrations, not the least caused by that ungrateful electorate. They'll do their best by gestures or comments that may assist their counterparts to deal with difficult domestic problems. The warmer the relationship, the more likely decisions are made during phone calls without considered advice from advisors or cabinets. For example, Bush, Schultz, the Hawke and the Gulf War, George W. Bush, Howard, Gulf War II, and the more likely bilateral problems can be played down or band-aided. And Carol wrote, and a bit of a, she thanked us for discussing the Saudi King's visit to Indonesia, which was earlier this year. I don't know whether any of you heard of it. It was a wonderful, Greg Feely had given, just did exactly what I thought, you know, a man fascinated by Indonesia, just had this whole different marvellous description about the gold ladder that came down from the plane and the 2,000 strong equerries and people who came with him, and he just made it live. She said it received very little coverage, and that was what he said. He couldn't believe how little coverage it got in Australia. Peter Harcher wrote about this in the Fairfax papers, but for what is such an important development, not just for Indonesia, but for us as well, their close neighbours, it was surprising. It went rather unnoticed. And we've had several comments on these sort of enjoyable discussions that have been really fascinating. You know, the fact that India didn't go to the Belt and Road Initiative. I didn't know that until we had this, didn't go. And you know, you've got the India and Japan now setting up these very interesting partnerships because they get on well. Modi and Abe get on well, apparently. Exactly what that man's talking about. Who knows where that all heads. So that, I felt great. I'm achieving that accessibility, some quite good jokes and laughter and a sense of people having a discussion that just includes them, in my opinion. Now, if you can tell me, if those of you have heard it, and I'm very, very, very welcome to take on some constructive advice if it's not working. But I'm pressing on, and I feel that it might take a year, even to 18 months, where we prove to people who are sort of making some of these decisions that we're not just scanning for the next cyclone, which is what I think, you know, I think a lot of foreign affairs coverage is, oh, you know, what's the next horror? We'll gird our loins. You know, I want it to be an enjoyable, stimulating value add. And my real dream is if people started to see it almost as a hobby that they read into and they enjoyed. And I think it gives you a heightened sense of being alive myself. Mm-hmm. I've certainly felt that. I've got it. And I want far more of my fellow Australians to sort of see the world in its multifarious, bewitching varieties and not to see that as a terrifying thing. So I want it to be a conversation, not a lecture or a tutorial if possible. And being the glass half full type, this is what I'll end on, I look for hope. I can't see the point in looking for the reverse, but I won't. I'm not a Pollyanna, I hope, but I do feel that it's worthwhile to seek possibilities where you may not have seen them. And I want to end with a wonderful remark that Alan Gingell, who set up the Lowy Institute, who is a former very, I think, we were talking earlier, Sue Boyd and I, about how much we admire him as a person who's contributed over so many years as a diplomat. He's just so constructive. Of course, he ended his career as a ONA, the head of ONA, and having also worked for Paul Keating, and he wrote this book recently, Fear of Abandonment, which he thinks is the best way to describe, if you look at a sort of sweep of Australia's foreign policy, he thinks that that is the thread. I think it's very clever. I think he's right. But this was a review by James Curran, who's a professor of politics at Sydney University, a very good review. Gingell is alive to the precarious situation in which Australia now finds itself. His conclusion is that the age of ambiguity and ambivalence, being able to balance the US alliance with an economic relationship with China, is fast drawing to a close. Adding to the challenge, the policy community now faces a public more sceptical of elite foreign policy views. The churn in political leadership hardly helps. New arguments and new narratives will need to be found. Those, alas, are not yet coming from the present foreign minister, he doesn't think. Gingell says Julie Bishop is not a conceptual thinker. You can debate that. Or the prime minister. But nor did they come from Rudd, Julia Gillard or Tony Abbott. The shaping of this new framework now appears to be an urgent task. Well, I think with the white paper coming, I thought that that was a perfect sort of call to arms. Maybe call to arms is the wrong little metaphor. Call to conversation. And I will look forward to hearing your views. Thank you.
Fabulous fellows lecture. Thanks, Geraldine. I wonder, I'm sure there are some hands going up for Geraldine's kindly agreed to some Q&A. And as a courtesy, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself. And first question over here.
Oh, thank you, John. Thank you very much, Geraldine. I'm very aware that yesterday was the 181st anniversary of the founding of the London Working Men's Club, which promulgated the People's Charter. You mentioned Petraeus saying that it is perhaps a generational struggle about many things, and we often think of fighting against the bad. But sort of taking what you're saying, I'm very much interested in generational struggles for the good.
Right.
And of course, Australia was the first country in the world to bring in the secret ballot, which is known in America in particular as the Australian ballot. Right. Now, I know that pride cometh before the fall, but Western Australia was the third place in the world to give women the vote. Yes, after New Zealand and South Australia. Yes, okay. And Australia was the first country in the world to give women the ability to stand for Parliament.
That's quite true.
Right. So I'm wondering if there are any particular things that you see as hopeful for representative democracy that perhaps you yourself like the idea, like just on Saturday you're mentioning, you know, the gerrymandering that happens in America. Oh my God, you know, at least we have a good Australian Electoral Commission here.
Yeah, we do.
Could it be taken up in America or other countries? Cause, so just the, maybe things that you see, you would like to see maybe from Australia to other places or from other places to Australia in terms of bettering representative democracy? Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question, and I think about this. I also serve on the Australian Peacekeepers Memorial Committee. We're unveiling a memorial on Anzac Avenue in Canberra that we've spent 8 years raising the money for because we're very good peacekeepers. And of course, we sent the first group in 1947 to Indonesia. We were amazing, and in fact, it's got me into thinking precisely what you're interested in. Where we seem to be particularly good at peacekeeping is that we believe in building institutions, and other countries don't necessarily. And so that things like the Australian Electoral Commission or sort of the work that we do in collection of taxes, like these things that don't sound exciting, but are absolutely crucial to building blocks to nations to emerge, we do believe in that, and we certainly did a lot of work in Iraq about the building of local councils, because I have a friend who was very involved in that, an ex-colonel, now a retired colonel. I mean, the interesting thing is that the American model has been so dominant for a while, which didn't believe in all of this. It specifically did not, and there's big arguments that Russia, when the fall of the Soviet Union happened, that sort of Chicago model, Chicago University model, was at its height, and just at the worst time to be at its height.
Bloody Hayek.
And I know, that's exactly right. And when I was in India three or four years back, and I was completely struck by I thought, my God, they've got the wrong model. This is precisely when they need the more British, you know, Keynesian model of the business of government-led, prudently under control model, and they had exactly the other model. And consequently, you know, we had extraordinary sort of Mumbai mansions and so on. Now, what will the Trump... I suspect that it's reached its peak now, and that notion of a more mixed model, with the Europeans now getting a lot more confidence, ironically, from Brexit and Trump, that's who would have ever predicted that. I suspect we might be heading back to a more managed democracy. A lot depends on what happens with Trump. And who knows? Who knows?
I still can't believe Ayn Rand was friends with Greenspan.
I know.
Thanks, John. James Trevelyan, former UWA, now running a small company, selling into Pakistan and India.
We can't hear this.
Running a small company selling air conditioners into Pakistan and India. One of the things I have noticed, at least in the West Australian community, is that since the end of the mining construction boom, even politicians have started to talk about diversifying our economy and how we have to engage with our near neighbours in Asia. Now, you go all over the country, I often get the impression that on the East Coast, there's much more attention focused on the US as being the source of economic investment and ties and so on, and not so much with Asia. Maybe with China, maybe with Japan, but certainly not Indonesia, Malaysia, India, and so on, that are much closer to us. Is that an accurate perception? Is there a difference between perceptions on the East Coast and the West Coast?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, I do feel when I come back here, it's a little less now than it was, just this unbelievable enmeshment with China, an amazing pride, and, you know, the pilgrim gets into your bones, and people start to see a magic and a majesty in those, that amazing snaking trains and so on. I think the East Coast is more diversified, you see, in its output, and it's more diversified into services. And therefore, I think it's not had to focus on Asia as much. Although there is very interesting work going on with Singapore now. The links with Singapore are really remarkable. But of course, Singapore is not really Asia. You know, when you go, it's not really. When you go there, because my daughter lives in Indonesia, I see Indonesia up close. And Singapore, you know, is an amazing model. So I think, you know, for instance, there's a great deal of interest now in exporting the nursing, the aged care and nursing home models. Now that is happening underway. I have friends involved in working with pharmaceutical companies in China. But look, against that, those front page stories about what happened to James Packer's employees, I just think they send shivers down boardrooms, massive shivers. And look, who could blame them? You know, that Jason O'Connor, I was reading the story today, that man who was the head of his, he was only visiting China. And he was passing through, and he's been in prison 9 months, he's going to get another 3 months. He had to plead guilty, and it obviously disturbed him immensely. And someone said, look, this is actually going to be gentle application of Chinese law. I think that probably set things back massively. So it's going to be like that for a while, until there is a really observable rule of law in China. It'll be one step forward and four steps back. Now, I don't know whether that's felt here in WA, but I tell you what, I think that is felt in the Eastern States, yes.
Robert.
Thanks so much, Geraldine. I'm Robert McFarlane. I'm with Leadership Western Australia now. And it's not an exaggeration to say that I opted to live in this country because of you.
Oh,
and your colleagues.
I wasn't expecting that.
And as I say, I'm only grateful to Donald Trump for one thing, and that's I no longer wake up and say, I so regret having resigned from the American Diplomatic Service. what I would like to pick your brain about is what can we do? I mean, I'm serious about saying that I think the ABC, I just got back from the States 3 days ago, and the dearth of grown-up conversation in our media in the US is just terrifying. And that it's not something new. And the ABC and SBS in particular, I think both of you are incredibly important in nation building and nation intelligence creation. And what can we as consumers do to support and voice the ongoing need for what you do? And how can we make your job and the existence of your organization easier?
Well, Robin, you can certainly let the people who matter, like Michelle Guthrie, and know this, because it's a struggle at the moment. There's no doubt about it. I think even though all the evidence is that newspaper journals like The Economist, The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, who've actually gone, if anything, they're more sure-footed in their ambitious coverage. They're doing very well, like literally loads of subscribers coming on. there's the sense that we're not meeting, the ABC is not meeting whole sections of the population. I'm not even denying that. But my argument is, if we don't satisfy this appetite for us, a conversation that stretches us, we won't be doing our job either. And I feel I need you all to think about a clever way of voicing that. Like, if you are going to write and to people who are making the decisions, don't sound like old fossils who don't... I'm sorry to put it like that, but that's how they put it. They say, oh, well, look, you know, they're dying off and they're not listening. They don't represent the new. Now, I just don't agree with this. And I think it's incumbent to show that you're not resistors. You actually are up to date. You know there are changing patterns. But the idea that we vacate that space is very, would be a tragedy. And so it needs to be expressed in that sense of, we know your dilemmas, but we would argue that if you don't cover this, no one will. And this is a time when Australia and its involvement with the world requiring a grown-up conversation, making the sorts of choices, helping the people in power to know that there is a very enlightened or sort of educated populace who's trying to tap into the dilemmas. It's not easy, any of this, which is why we need a good enlightened conversation. So I do appeal to you all to write like that, because it's really tough at the moment. Thank you.
Javier.
Thank you very much, Geraldine, for your brilliant address. Flavia Bellini Zimmerman, AWIAWA. You were mentioning about the constant tension that we have here in Australia to balance our relationship with America and China. And also you mentioned the danger of political vacuums, not only in our region, but in the world. In the light of the new US administration, I'm just wondering to which extent the possible abandonment of the Pivot for Asia is going to impact our region and Australia in the way...
The abandonment of...
The Pivot for Asia.
The
Pivot?
Pivot, got it,
yes. For Asia.
Yep.
And how this is going to impact the relationship, the Australia-China relationship, and to which extent we are going to still have a healthy and strong relationship with America if they just reposition themselves in our region.
Well, look, who knows what the pivot is or where it will be? There's a real debate, as I see it anyway, about what this pivot really means, whether Trump, for instance, really cares about it. But he's in foreign affairs, I really think it is Jim Mattis, who's Secretary of Defence, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and H.R. McMaster, who's the National Security Advisor. Those three men are really running the place as foreign affairs, and we better be very grateful they are, I think, because I think they are more conventional. And I was at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore just a few weeks back and had the amazing experience of seeing Jim Mattis speak. It was quite extraordinary, actually, and to watch them hanging off the rafters because they knew that here was somebody whom they thought they needed to know how he was seeing things. And... they could trust him to that. I mean, this issue of trust, you know, people talk about trust in domestic affairs, but I've come to realise trust in international affairs is a very, very important factor too. He didn't talk about the pivot as such. The Chinese, I think, are sitting there watching, trying to work out how to behave as international citizens. At last week's Crawford Forum at the ANU that I attended, which had some very good conversations, there was a leading Chinese academic, and he's just one, but he's a good one, I think. And he emphasised, and so did a woman called Linda Jacobson, who's an Australian who's lived there for years and is now here, that China has this unbelievable need for perceived legitimacy, both with its own population, this is the regime, and in the world, and that it is learning, this man stressed it, this very elegant Chinese academic, China is learning how to adopt internationally international leadership positions. I thought it was an amazing remark. And that, therefore, it does matter what people say. Like, we might all say, well, do they listen to us, you know? Do they listen to Australia, or do they listen to what Malaysia says, or whatever? Yes, they do, if he's to be believed. They're quite nervous about where they sit. They know they aren't yet good at it. This AIIB, the Australian Institute, investment bank, there was a very elegant ex-bureaucrat who was running that, came out and addressed us all in Sydney recently in this very interesting conversation, and I was really struck by, he basically said, we are not playing by Chinese rules. We are playing by international rules of probity and prudence and international finance. And he kept saying it.
I thought... It's a Chinese person.
Chinese man. Mm-hmm. And initially I was a bit taken aback, and then I realised, I know what he's doing. He and this man last week said, we are setting up institutions like the bank where we prove we know how to behave. Amazing. Now, I think this is confidence providing, but it shows you that we're in this very interesting fluid stage.
Thanks. We've got at least two more questions. One, Sue first.
Chairman, Sue was former president of this organisation before John took it over so magnificently. I just want to say congratulations on your fellowship.
Thank you.
That you've joined the group of fellows at the Institute. But what that did is recognise the really long commitment you've made to advancing international relations through the various media openings that have been opened to you, the various roles you've played. You've been constant at this for many years, so I want to congratulate you on that. But I also want to say good on you for continuing to fight for the foreign affair segment in your program. It's terrific. The Institute of International Affairs has branches in every state, and we have amongst our members in every state people who are really very knowledgeable, but don't necessarily make the headlines of international affairs and have particular areas of expertise. So what I would say is, can I offer you that palette of talent which you could call upon in your programs that come? Thank you very much.
Yes, you can indeed, in fact. And, you know, it's really tricky. For instance, we've got this young woman working for us at the moment, and I said her before I came, I said, now, I want us to do something on Qatar. She's only visiting. She's been in Tamworth for 2.5 years, and I said, "No, I want you to do something on Qatar." I saw the eyes go. And I said, "And I want someone from there. I don't want an the great people. So the people will come onto the program and they say, "Oh, well, look, there's a very good lecturer in European affairs who's in Melbourne." I say, "Where was he last in Europe?" "Oh, well, a few years." "No," I say, "no, not interested in that." In other words, you know, you've got to get people who are on the ground or keeping themselves visibly up to date, because it's so fluid. Now, a lot of people, they may well fall into exactly that category, but, you know, that's my argument, is that I want people who know how to seduce people into it, and who are clearly exuberant about that, you know, not the grim, that sort of grim, you know, I'm going to speak and acronyms, you know, acronym central, and I'm going to be so frightfully pompous and so on. I don't want that. I don't want that. I just think that almost embeds it, you know, that if you haven't, literally, if you don't have a doctorate in international relations, you know, don't bother turning up. I want to scuttle that, but I will listen to your suggestions.
And I think probably the last question here. Well, there's room for one over there. Talk about over here.
Thanks. Harvey Collins, I'm a company director. I'm on the board of Save the Children Australia, and I'm involved in social venture capital in Asia. particular involvement in countries like Cambodia and Myanmar, and one of the things that strikes me, and I've just come back from a visit to Myanmar, the comments you get about, we like working with Australians, you are pragmatic, you have our best interests at heart, you're not tangled in a lot of politics. How do we bring those water cooler conversations that I hear when I'm in Yangon or Phnom Penh back to Australia, because it seems that that's a great way to humanise the conversations back here.
Harvey, if I could work that out, I would. Look, I know exactly what you're talking about. In Indonesia, it's startling, and I don't think I'm overstating it. They will tell you that the Americans provide the money, but they like working with us because we don't have the hierarchies that the British have. We're much flatter. We'll go and have a beer. We don't want to get too carried away with ourselves, but I think that our style is much more geared to the type of clever state building, and you know, it's called statecraft or peace building, nation building, whatever, than a lot of the other more hierarchical societies. The hierarchies seem to be a real problem. So people who've often got the money have also bring hierarchies with them. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. Now, I mean, if you're in a really shooting war, you might, you know. I obviously, if you're in a place where you've got to bring in Chapter 7 peacekeeping regulations and everything, yes, you may want, you know, General Petraeus there. Thank you very much. But, like, to get... As soon as you can get past that, which everybody wants to get past anyway, you want to open the schools, you know, you want to set up the courts, you want to have the roads working, you want the engineers working, you want all of that visible. The Australians are very good at it, very good indeed. And, oh, look, I've thought about this. One of the things I wouldn't mind doing, you know, is writing a... and I may well do this, like a gorgeous sort of drama about peacekeeping, the business of what's involved. Like a friend of mine's daughter writes the checks for the in the UN, and she is the one. She apparently answered an ad. Her mother said, I think it's such a gorgeous story, I'm going to do something with this. She's just from up the road near me. She was at a loose end, she had a relationship breakup, she was a lawyer, she was thinking, what am I going to do with my life? The mother noticed a little ad for someone who was interested in world affairs in some form, who wanted to contribute. She put it on the girl's bed without saying anything, because she said you didn't sort of, you know, didn't interfere. So the young woman applied, and she is now signing checks to send peacekeepers off. She's in charge of the budget for the UN sending peacekeepers. Wonderful story. Wonderful story. And she, I don't think she'll ever come home, but you know, what a job. What a contribution to make. Now, I'm sure that somehow or other we can make that live. Got to work out how you can make these stories live for people. So you're not just having the warriors, you know, not the people who make the war, but who makes the peace? That's what I want to make it sexy. Who makes the peace? Which is really what you're talking about. Mm. We're not there yet, though.
Mm. Well, on that note, Geraldine, thanks so much for an excellent fellows.
Thank you.
Lecture. And congratulations on being a very own West Australian fellow. I wonder if I could ask Professor Samina Yasmin to move a vote of thanks.
Well, I guess whatever I say would be in my capacity both as a member of the Australian Institute for International Affairs and also someone who runs the Centre for Muslim States and Societies. And I do want to point out that we're not only two female fellows from AAIA. Sue Boyd is also here, who's been part of the group. It's been great listening to you, because I think in terms of what international politics is and how we need to understand that in today's world and what kind of agency or activism we can get engaged in. It really relies very strongly on our ability and willingness to open our minds and not be parochial in a globalized world. And I'm so glad that you drew attention to the fact that the more we are globalized, the more media in Australia but elsewhere is engaged in the process of parochializing our minds. And so we tend to forget what's really happening outside. So the fact that you are so committed to foreign affairs plus S, foreign affairs, I think it's a great change. And it's also important because I think unless and until we bring out the human aspect of international relations, we can't really prepare ourselves or other next generation to deal with what's happening in the world. I'm glad that you, I'm not glad what happened to your son-in-law, but I'm glad that we started off by drawing attention to an issue that's so significant. And again, I think if we are willing to open our minds and go beyond those boundaries that we have created and are increasingly creating for ourselves, we would be more open to understanding what's happening and not dealing with it after it's suddenly staring us in the face.
That's right.
And I guess I'm so glad you talked about Qatar because I was just thinking there are two stories that are going to stay with me. One is in 1990 when Kashmir issue blew up, and having been born in Pakistan, it was sort of something straight away pick it up. And I mentioned it to somebody, and I was told that somebody in ABC said, Kashmir is not on our map. Very recently, and I'm so glad you mentioned Qatar, because I've been following, before it blew up, a story about how Saudi government was saying that Qatari, I mean, was not really a descendant of Wahhab, which is a very indirect dig at him. But when it blew up, I mentioned to someone, that, how about if I write something for you? And they said, we're too busy with terrorism. And it was just amazing. I just thought, the last thing you want to do is miss out what's happening on ground and its long-term impact on terrorism. So it was really very good that you talked about the fact that there is more to international relations than what is being presented. And so I'm so happy, so proud, and on behalf of everyone, congratulate you on being the new fellow of AIIA. And give you this very, very...
just for the plane.
Just for the plane. What if I got it?
One thing, because I should say, the person who massively influenced me at university was Sue Boyd.
Yeah.
When she was in president, I can still remember sitting there as a callow little person, I was told of this before, where she was dominating the stage there in the big hall, whose name stood, you know,
Winthrop.
And I thought, wow, you know, the nuns didn't prepare me for all of this. She was magnificent with all of, and witty, and, you know, I could see there was profanities just below her, just below the surface. She was marvellous, so I should acknowledge that very strongly, and I mean that.
Can't top that. Talking about neighbourhood.
That's right.
Selena, I wonder if you could just stay here for a minute as well, because I'm not going to talk about the bursary. We've already done that, but as we know, Selena is our Professor of Political Science and International Relations at UWA, and she runs the Centre for Muslim States and Societies. She's also a fellow of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, as we know. But tonight, just while you're up here, we'd like to recognise you as a member of the Institute, a donor to the Institute, a committee member to the Institute, a vice president of the Institute, and a fellow of the Institute. And with that, we'd like to award you life membership of the Institute.
I don't know what to say.
You're welcome to say. Would you like to say something, Simon? No, it's come out of that field. So that's from all of us in deep appreciation, so thanks. Our next meeting is on the 25th of July, and it's another special winter hours, winter start, the 5:30 start for a 6 o'clock event, because it's the deepest winter here in Perth, as visitors will have noticed. But here we go. Our next speaker is Tom Vincent, who's the PF, Perth International Arts Festival Film Program Manager. And I won't spoil what I'm going to say next time, but PF will start exactly the same time by exactly the same person as the person who started the Institute of International Affairs here in Western Australia. But Tom will talk about the Cannes Film Festival and global perspectives, and will show us a mystery movie as well, yet to be revealed. But those of you who have met Tom will know that he is a passionate film person, and he's really talking about the Cannes Festival from its openings in 1939 as the Festival of the Free World to what it does today. So that's probably, there it goes again. So that's our next meeting, so I welcome you all to come to that. Film nights tend to be pretty good. We had Casablanca a few years ago. I'm surprised a number of people hadn't seen it. It's terrific. Someone brought a newspaper from that day. It was a terrific night. Popcorn and pizzas. So that's our next meeting, so I encourage you all to attend that. Just be wary of the 5:30 start again. And then finally, I'd like to thank everyone who made tonight possible, and that's an excellent committee. An excellent Centre for Muslim States and Society, and an excellent speaker who flew over specially for tonight. So thank you, Geraldine.